Okay, very good. So that recorder is now working. Since I don't trust it yet, we'll even try this. And we'll be thoroughly documented. Okay, so this is, we're now in, I guess, the third real lecture of the, the computational biology class. Any questions about anything that came up last class? Last class we had, taught two very good and useful presentations about GenBank and Perl. Okay, any questions about those that came to mind when people were thinking about it? Okay, so what is it that we know now? We should now know from our previous classes, we should now know a little bit of biology, at least enough biology to know that DNA sequences are good things. We should know enough computer science to know that fast algorithms are good things. Okay? And what we're now going to start looking at is one of the more significant and inspiring applications of computer science and algorithms to biology. And that has to do with actually sequencing the human genome. Most everybody, I'm sure, has heard of this Human Genome Project, or heard that, I guess, about 2 years ago now, there was a big ceremony announcing that the human genome had been sequenced. Maybe it was a year ago, I think. And this was the international news, front page news. What did it mean? Okay, well, we know that sequencing is, in some sense, the act of reading the DNA sequence of a particular genome, okay, of a particular sequence in mind. And so basically, the sequencing of the human genome was taking essentially a representative person, okay, and sequencing all 3 billion base pairs of information that is in their genome, okay? And somehow, since different people don't vary too much from each other in their DNA sequence, roughly 1 out of every 1,000 pairs differ among people. Once you sequence one person, you know a tremendous amount about, humanity and how humans work and what the proteins in humans are and things like that. So sequencing the human genome was a tremendous scientific breakthrough that, involved hundreds of scientists and probably on the order of $1 billion worth of experimenting. The thing that I find most intriguing about it is that in some sense I think the intellectual breakthrough that led to the human genome being sequenced was something done by computer scientists, okay? When anybody says, who sequenced the human genome? I think you can, with a straight face, say it was the computer scientists that did that. And I'd like to try to prove that to you in the following way. Here is the author of the paper there were 2 different papers that were produced announcing the sequencing of the human genome. This is the list of authors of the first paper. They were both produced at the same time, the paper. But this is the paper produced by the Celera group. Okay, we'll learn today that there were 2 groups that were doing this simultaneously. But if you look at it, there's a large list of authors, about 200 authors on this paper. But I've highlighted several of them in yellow. The ones that are in yellow are the computer scientists that I know of who were involved in this project. So just look at the yellow should show you that a substantial number of the people who were involved in making the project happen were computer scientists. But it's even more interesting than that, I think. Let's look at the authors from beginning to end. They're ordered somehow by importance or something like that. The first person, Craig Venter, is the guy who got $1 billion to sequence it. Okay? So he called the shots, he started the company, he got to put his name first. Okay? His henchman, okay, his right-hand man, the guy that was sort of the manager of the company, is the second author. The third author is Gene Myers, okay, whose name will come up a couple times today. He's a born and bred algorithms person. Okay, not too much different than me. It's smarter, harder working, but basically not that much different. Okay, and in some sense, it is to him that I think the credit can go to, with the intellectual idea that led to the human genome being sequenced, at least sequenced as rapidly as it was. Okay, if we go through the rest of it again, you'll see that the fifth author here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I guess sixth author, is another computer scientist. Okay. The seventh author is a guy named Hamilton Smith. Does anyone know who he was? Now, he's a Nobel Prize winner. But notice he's the one behind the two computer scientists. He's back with the test tube washers and all the other people who make the project going. Okay? And then you have, again, different waves of computer scientists involved in the project. Okay? Many of these are quite prominent computational biologists. Some were involved in the assembly. Some were involved in the analysis of the sequence after it was obtained, the raw sequence, trying to analyze where the genes were and things like that. Okay? But as you can see, I think it's an impressive list, and it's something that the computer science community can be proud of, okay, of their participation in this project. Any questions about the author list? Yes? The projector is, the names are actually all printed in the same font, okay? Again, the people back here were presumably somehow less important than the people up there, but they're all, but it was not, they didn't shrink the font. They just, that's the projector. Any questions about that? Yes? The question is, are all the non-computer scientists molecular biologists? It's probably true that the answer is undoubtedly no, because when you have 200 people here, they're undoubtedly here for different reasons. Okay? I am sure, I don't know what all these people do, and it's probably not even true that the lead author knows what all these people do. Okay? But I imagine a lot of them were biologists. Some were involved in the high level of designing the experiment and implementing the experiment. Some were probably more technicians, actually doing some of the hands operation. People were probably involved in lots of different stages. Okay? So these are only the computer scientists I know. I might have missed some. Okay? Most of the rest, I will guess, are probably biologists, but I would say it's probably not all of them. Any other questions? Okay? So what to me is kind of interesting is we're going to talk over the next couple of classes about the what is the basic laboratory technology, how do you actually sequence things, and where do the computer scientists come in? The other thing I'd like to, why were there two different groups that tried to sequence the human genome in two different ways, okay? And both sides said the other side was crazy for the way they were trying to do it. And we'll try to understand why they felt that way. And we can, you can later make your opinion as to who was right or wrong. One thing I'd like to show you that I think is very interesting is the sort of the dramatic progress in the size of sequencing projects that happened. Okay? The original, the primary method for doing DNA sequencing, at least at the chemical level, was developed in 1977. And to prove that it worked, they sequenced a little virus that was about 5,000 bases long. Okay? About 5 years later, there was a larger virus, something called Lambda, bacteriophage Lambda. Bacteriophage means a virus that infects bacteria. That's about 50,000 bases long. And this was a great accomplishment in 1982. And to a certain extent, that was about as large as genomes got sequenced, okay, for the next 10 years or so. Then in 1995, the first bacterial genome was sequenced. That was about 2 million bases long, okay? And then 5 years later, the fruit fly was sequenced, which was 100 times longer than that, okay? And then a year later, the human was sequenced, which was 10 times longer than that. So there's really quite a dramatic scale-up in something, okay? And, it's a combination of experimental technologies and computational technologies and just sort of a race to get the job done, okay? But we'll see how it works now. Any questions? Yeah, questions?
Hey, thank you for your experience.
So the question of what do they actually find out? Basically, at least for a first approximation, sequencing the human genome involves reading every base, every character in the string. So in some sense, a byproduct of sequencing, it should be the exact length of the genome.
Okay.
You're getting essentially the exact bases, the pattern of exact bases. And of course, there's a certain amount of error, so it's not going to be 100% exact. And as we'll see with humans, there's gaps and regions where they don't have the sequence, even though they've declared the project sort of finished. Okay. But it's still sort of basically reading a large string of bases that sort of from the molecule. Any questions? Okay. So
So how is it that DNA sequencing machines work? Okay, well, what is a DNA sequencing machine?
Again, if you look at a DNA sequencing machine,
it looks like a refrigerator. Okay, it's a refrigerator with doors on it. Okay, maybe it cost, they cost a couple $100,000 perhaps, okay, for a good one. But basically you're buying one that looks like a refrigerator. But what it is a DNA sequencing machine works according to the basic technology. The technology in sequencing machines is really the same technology that was used in the original sequencing back in 1977 by something called the Gilbert-Sanger method. Gilbert and Sanger are two biologists. And what it does is it's the sequencing machines take as input a test tube of DNA, and as output will a test tube of short fragments of DNA, which short is about 500 bases, okay? And as output prints out the pattern of letters, the pattern of bases, A, C, G, and T, that molecule has. So the important properties of these machines are, first of all, that they can only sequence fairly short molecules, where short is defined, I will say it's 500, some people will say it's 700, some people say their machine's good to 1,000 bases, okay? But basically you can sequence short molecules. And the way that it works is using two of the technologies we mentioned a few classes ago. PCR, okay, does anyone remember what PCR does? What was PCR for? Polymerase chain reaction. What would we use PCR for? What? To duplicate the DNA, to make lots and lots of copies of a given molecule. The other thing that we use is electrophoresis. Does anyone remember what electrophoresis does? What was that used for? Yeah? That would measure the length of the DNA molecule. Okay? It would measure the length of a fragment. So using the fact that we can make lots of copies of a molecule and that we can measure the length of it, how can we use those two technologies to sequence something? The basic idea is the following. We're going to take out, we have, let's say, one 500 length molecule we want to sequence. First thing we can do is use PCR to make lots and lots of copies of it. So now we have lots of, as many copies of it as we want. In fact, what we're going to do is to create four distinct test tubes or bins, okay, each of which starts out with one copy of the same molecule, and we're going to use PCR in each bin to make lots and lots of copies, but in such a way that that it fluoresces. Let me explain it on a blackboard. That might be actually easier if I had some chalk. We have any chalk here?
Oh, good, man. Good, man. Okay. So how is it that the basic idea as to how sequencing will work, at least conceptually? We are going to create in four different test tubes lots and lots of copies of the original molecule we want to sequence. We start out with one molecule we want to sequence. Let's say we use PCR to make four copies of it and stick one in each test tube. Now, we can use PCR to make lots and lots of copies in each test tube. But we're going to make the copies in a special way, in a way that it sort of breaks at certain phases. Okay? So, let me just see if I can explain this sort of simply. We are going to create the molecules in such a way that when the copying happens, there is a fluorescently marked starting molecule. The copies are then going to grow from that fluorescently starting molecule, but the growing is going to be in such a way that each test tube is going to have defective bases. So this molecule is going to be, the molecule we're trying to copy is made of A, C's, G's, and T's. In this test tube, we're going to have both good A's and defective A's. So when we do the copying and a defective A gets stuck in there, the molecule is going to end right at that point.
Okay? So you can think of the copying process as copying prefixes of the molecule. Okay? Writing in this case at every A, or occasionally at A's, in this step loop occasionally breaking at C's, in this test loop occasionally breaking at T's, and in this test loop occasionally breaking at G's. Okay? So after we've done this copying process, what we've got in any test loop is a mixture of fragments, all of which have the radial label on it, or the fluorescent label, all of which are prefixes of the complete 500 base molecule, and which end someplace randomly, in this case it is A, in this case it is C, in this case it is G, in this case it is T. Okay? Any questions about that? I realize that may have been comforting a little bit. Now, suppose we have this mixture of all places where we can break A's. Let's say our sequence was A, C, C, A, C, G, A. Suppose that was the molecule we were trying to sequence. What happens if I now measure the length of the fragments of the mixture that gets created by taking all prefixes broken into A's? Sometimes it's going to break here at the end of the first base, right? It's not going to break at the end of the second base because the A's were never, it's only the A's that might break. It's not going to break at the end of the third base. But some of the molecules will have ended at the end of the fourth base, right? Some of the molecules will have ended at the end of the fifth base. None will have ended at the end of the sixth base. And some of them will have ended at the end of the seventh base. Okay? If we measure the length of these molecules, what we should get, okay, if in fact the test loop contains all fragments ending in A, we're going to get a ladder of some fragments, of certain lengths for which fragments exist, and certain lengths for which fragments don't exist. And by measuring exactly where the fragments exist, that's really telling us where the A's are in the molecule. Is that sort of believable or clear on a conceptual level as to how this is working? Yes. Yes. Okay. You need a little bit of DNA to start with, yes. Okay? So we're gonna have one, the original, we started out with one molecule. Okay? We made a bunch of copies. Then in this chamber here, we're gonna do amplification but with both good A's and bad A's. And the bad A's will break. Okay? And that's why here we've got a lot of copies of the molecule, but only prefixes, but all prefixes ending in A's. Okay? Yes? So a way to think about it is, let's say that we were putting, let's say that one out of every, we have good A's and bad, when we add chemicals and reagents to this, that are, we have both the ability to make good A's that don't break, and bad A's that break. Suppose one out of every 100 A's were bad A's. Then roughly 1% of the molecules will break here. Something like another 1% of the molecules will break here. Okay? So if I have this small amount of bad A's, okay, I imagine that most of the time it's going to get past the hurdles of replicating the first one. Okay, and only break occasionally. Okay? If I had only bad A's, you're right, I would only get that fragment. Okay? But if the copying process is going to break occasionally, because they're making billions of copies of this thing, 1% of billions is still a lot. Okay? Enough to measure. Okay? Any questions? Questions? I like to measure the length of the molecule. The way we measure the length of the molecule was this electrophoresis technique we mentioned, which is that we're going to take these mixture of molecules, or at one end of a piece of jello, okay? Jello, some gel, we call it a gel, okay? You will put an electric field on one end of the gel. These molecules are charged, because molecules do that, okay? They will be attracted to this charge. The molecule is going to try to walk up the gel towards this charge. And how far they walk is going to depend upon how fast they walk depends upon how heavy they are. So the short fragments are going to race ahead, and just the single A's are going to go there. You're going to walk for 10 minutes. The small molecules will walk a certain amount. Slightly heavier molecules will walk less. By knowing how fast a molecule of a particular weight will walk, you can correlate that to length, and thus measure the length of the A's. Okay? Any questions? So why will this only work for 700 bases or so? Well, first of all, realize that running anything on a piece of jello is going to be errors. Okay? And so somehow you need to be able to measure when you see a band. You have to measure accurately enough that this band, let's say here, at one point in the sequence we had two consecutive A's. You have to somehow be able to distinguish between a molecule of length 100 and a molecule of length 101. So you need a certain amount of precision in order to be able to tell that fine a distinction. Okay? And to make sure that molecules are small. Telling the difference between a molecule with 100 nucleotides is not, it's very similar in weight to something that weighs 101 nucleotides. If we have a race of all the people in this room, okay, the person who's heavier will be slower. But you need to have a fairly long race in order to distinguish someone who weighs 100 pounds from someone who weighs 101 pounds, right? Where that extra weight will catch up with them, okay? So you need to have a long race track for that. And the resolution on the gel to do that is limited. So you can only get a spacing of, let's say, about 500 different measurements before the accuracy breaks down. Okay? So that's grossly accurate, what I said. Any questions? So we don't get a question. So that's very good. So I would say that you're only getting three pictures. How do I know that I don't have an intermediate spread may also got duplicated? And the answer is you're 100% right, it might have gotten duplicated. But remember, we started the molecule, we grew it in some sense from a radioactive, from a fluorescently labeled or radioactive end. So in fact, in other crud from walking up this gel corresponding to other pieces. But the only pieces we can detect were the ones that had the fluorescent marker at the end. Okay? So there are other fragments walking up the gel that you don't see them. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So really what happens when you do DNA sequencing machine, what do you get as an output? You're basically having four different lanes.
One measuring the places where the A's are, one measuring the C's, the G's, and the T's.
The output of one of your sequencing machines is essentially going to be a set of curves which measures the amount of fragments ending with each letter, okay, that get detected at each position. Okay, and in principle, the highest curve is the one that would represent the base that gets called. Okay? So in a well-adjusted sequencing machine, like here if you look at it, you probably can see it says G, 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 G. Here you have very nicely, you have three separate peaks corresponding to molecules of that length ending in G. If you look, not all the peaks are perfectly defined. Here you've got a little peak as well as a big peak. Okay? But somehow interpreting which lane has more of the molecules of that length, from that you can make a call as to what the base probably is. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So these machines will work. They can sequence something about length 500. there's a certain amount of error associated with it. Roughly, depending upon who's doing the sequencing, how good your machine is, maybe 2% of the time, the bases will be called wrong. Okay? But it's still pretty accurate, you know, but not perfectly accurate. Okay? But reasonably good, let's say an error rate of about 2% per fragment in the range of a fragment of about 501. Any questions? Questions? Given this, do we have a way to verify it? The answer is not really. Okay? So there is no, I mean, you could always sequence it again and again and again and see how often you get the same answer. But there is no clean way you can sort of take the molecule and verify its sequence. Okay? I mean, there are ways you can do it, but it's expensive, it's not done. Okay? Any questions? Questions? Okay, so how do you decide which peak is significant? Well, that's a complicated image processing type of a problem. So there exist programs, the question of making the call, which base do you mean, okay, is not a trivial bit of processing. I mean, if the data was clean enough, it would be trivial to say, yes, you know, the A peak is much higher here than the C or the G or the D. Therefore, we'll call it an A. But there's often noise. You know, in some sense, you want to run the machine for as long a sequence as you can, and that means that you want to, you know, you're pushing the accuracy on these things. Turns out there's programs that do that kind of image analysis. There's a famous one called Thread. Okay, is probably the most famous one. But that's basically an image reading and analysis program that makes the calls. Okay, so it's a tricky problem, but it's not a problem we're probably going to talk too much more about. Okay? Any questions?
What does this graph show?
What?
This is
graph show. So now, how do we read one of these cells? Okay? We agreed that on the A lane of the gel, I'm going to get bands corresponding to where does the A look.
In fact, you can imagine I'm running four lanes of this. I have an A, C, G, and T gel. If everything is perfect on the T lane, I'm going to get bars there. And on the C lane, I'm going to get a bar here. And on the G bar lane, I'm going to get a bar there. But of course, nothing is perfect when you're measuring molecules. Okay? So there's always going to be a certain amount of trust on one of these gels. And so what this is really measuring, those curves is measuring how much stuff is there in that particular lane. Okay, how much fluorescence was detected at that position. Okay? And from analyzing these curves, in principle, the high bumps are going to represent real bases. But there's going to be false bumps, there's going to be low bumps, there's going to be places where somebody spit out the gel, something funny happened. Okay? So it's a tricky business. Okay, so there's some error, but
but again, you can figure that it's accurate about 2% of the time. Okay, it makes about 2% errors here, base calling errors. Any questions? Okay, and again, just to sort of firm this thing up, here is an example. Again, you can't see it on my slide isn't very good, but here is a picture of a gel, and you can sort of see these bars, these bands that represent where there is something that you should be detecting. Okay? But again, you know, obviously my slide and this photo duplication made it hard to read. But, you know, realize that these are physical things and reading them, there's going to be error. Okay? This is not a digital process. This is a very analog thing. And you got to measure it. Yeah?
So the previous graph, why not those, why do we expect spikes rather than, why is this good?
Well, why aren't there spikes? Well, in an ideal world,
okay, it would be perfectly smooth. Okay, in an ideal world, at exactly molecules of this length, suddenly you would get all of, you know, at the right length, suddenly you get all the molecules, there would be a perfect spike. But remember, it's a physical process. Things happen. We're measuring how fast the molecules walk up this jello. Maybe the jello is a little thicker at one point than at another point. And the band is going to be wavy depending upon how thick or thin or slow dense the jello is. Okay?
Or maybe on certain places, the amplification process worked better than others. And so maybe you made more copies of short fragments than long fragments. Okay? And, you know, your ability to distinguish a 100-pound, you know, if you think about it, it's a lot easier to measure, tell the difference between short things than long things. So, for example, again, think about this as a race where we're having a race and we want to figure out who's carrying the heavier object. I think that's a good analogy here. Okay? I'll be very good at telling the difference between the person who's carrying the 100-pound object and who's carrying the 1-pound object. Okay? But it's not, you know, he was assigned to carry the 100-pound object, okay? And he was assigned to carry the 99-pound object. I'm not sure that, that he's going to win the race, okay? There's going to be noise and slop in any such experimental procedure, okay? So you've got to realize that there are errors, and to me it's quite understandable that there are errors. Okay? It's easy for us as the data analysis people to say, why don't you do your experiments better, okay? But after a while, the biologists will look at you and say, you do it, okay? You know, and so I think that's perfectly fair. Any question? Well, this particular gel is inspired. I don't know where I stole this gel from. So it's actually probably not really doing sequence. Probably, maybe one of, there's four columns and maybe there's a control column. So you know what it should be in that last column so you can tell whether everything is really messed up. Yeah. Well, from one fragment in isolation, you don't really know where the errors were. If they were, you wouldn't make them. You then do the analysis, and your program spread would be smart enough to take care of it. Basically, after you have analyzed one fragment in isolation from a good sequencing machine where you've done your informatics properly, figure you've got 2% error left in the sequence. Okay? That's probably, you know, again, depending on who you're talking about, maybe they'll say 1%, maybe they'll say 5%, okay? But errors happen, and you got to deal with them, okay? Yeah. How much time does it take to read a sequence? These gels typically run in what I will say is on the order of, let's say, an hour, okay? Depends a little bit upon how your technology is. Obviously, the stronger a current you use, the faster the molecule will walk up, but maybe that causes other bad things. But I think on the order, these things work on the order of an hour to sequence these things. Maybe it's a couple hours, something like that. Okay? And in fact, those high-end sequencing machines are the things that look like refrigerators. Not, you know, they tend to have a lot of robotics in there so they can load samples themselves. So in an ideal world, what one of these machines will do is just say, well, here are 100 fragments I'd like to sequence, okay? The machine will sequence them one by one and do all the data, the materials handling, so that you don't have to feed the machine very often. In one of the factories where they really do large-scale sequencing, maybe a human will go to the machine once a day to add new chemicals and clean it out. Okay, they're really kind of aggressive operations. Okay, but figure it's like an hour or so to walk up the gel. Yeah?
Do we have such machines at Stony Brook?
Do we have such machines at Stony Brook? The answer is yes, and you will actually get a chance to see them. If you look at the course schedule, I think like October 22nd or so, I have scheduled a field trip to the sequencing center. Okay, and so we will go take a look and see what these things do. But I warn you that they look like refrigerators. And if you want to say, what do they do, it's what does a refrigerator do? Okay? So I think it'll be fun to have a field trip, but don't get too excited. Okay? It used to be actually a lot more exciting to look at these machines before you had all the automation. In the old days, when they were sequencing viruses, all this work was done by graduate students. And they were actually building Jell-O and letting it cool and running it. And, you know, this is very human labor intensive. And that was a lot more fun to watch. Okay? But, of course, much slower, much more errors. More demanding on graduate students. Any questions? Okay, so the basic technology you should believe is we can get small fragments with a small but not zero error rate. Any questions? Okay? Now, sequencing small fragments is nice, but what we really want to do, to sequence a genome, we want to sequence something that's a million bases long if it's a bacteria, or a billion bases long if it's human, or mouse, or something like that. How do we sequence big things, knowing that all we can do is sequence small fragments. So the basic technology is something called shotgun sequencing. Okay? And it works like this. And let's look at the picture and see if we can do this. So here I have an unknown, a sequence, a genome that I want to sequence, which is big. So what can I do to it? Well, let's say I make lots of copies of that genome. Okay? And let's say I now take extracted DNA from all these copies and chop it up in a blender. Okay? So that every fragment is about 500 bases long, let's say. Well, I can actually have longer fragments, but maybe I can only sequence the 500 bases at the end of each fragment. Okay? And now I have a lot of fragments which were randomly sampled from the genome. Okay? How do I know they were randomly sampled? Well, it was chopped up in a blender. Okay? So, you know, there's no skewing or, in principle, no bias because of where it was in the blender. Okay? And I've got lots of random fragments I extract. I'm going to extract one fragment at a time, sequence 500 bases of it, and then go and work on another fragment. Okay? And so I'm going to sequence a large number of random 500 base pieces of the genome. Then once I have a large number of such random pieces, what I'm now going to try to do is to assemble it by looking for overlaps. Okay? So, you know, what's going to be ideally, I'd like to now that I have these individual sequences, I'm now going to try to apply a computer program, an assembler, to try to figure out what fragment overlaps what, and based on the overlap structure, you know, figure out the sequence of the entire thing. Any questions about the big general strategy? Yes?
Why do you need to make copies of the genome? Why can't we just take one genome?
Okay, so first question is why don't we just take one copy of the
molecule? One molecule for the whole human genome.
And just cut it up in the blender, okay? And sequence the pieces, and then put it back together. Well, first of all, you have to be, molecules are small things, and you have to make sure you get every piece, okay? But even if I gave you every piece from it being chopped up in the blender, can you now, do you have enough information to put the molecule back together again? No. There's no overlap. Suppose, let's say, I want to sequence A, C, T, let's say this is it. And I put it in the blender, I chop it up like this, and now I go sequence the pieces, let's do an alphabetical order, A, C, 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 T, and C, T. Based on this, what was the original sequence? Was it A, C, 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 T, 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 T? Or was it TTTCCAA? Even if you have all the fragments of one molecule, any permutation of them, in theory, is equally likely to express what the sequence is. So you don't have enough information without overlap. Okay? Any other questions? Questions?
Even if there are overlaps, you can't guarantee a sequence. Okay,
so the question is, even with overlaps, you can't guarantee a unique sequence. Can anybody give me a proof of that? Can someone give me a sequence that even if I have overlaps, even if you know, I have all the overlaps, I can't sequence it exactly? What if, let's say, the sequence was A, 700,000 times A. All A's, 1,000 A's. Every sequence I fragment, fragment I sequence is going to be 500 A's. Okay? I don't know if the sequence is going to be, the data I would get would be consistent with any number of A's, okay, in a row. Right? So that's a trivial example that is not necessarily uniquely reconstructed. But if we avoid weird things, and if we have enough evidence, we can do a pretty good job of putting it back together again. Okay, can we do a perfect job? Not necessarily,
okay? But we're not necessarily worried about perfection. We want to do the best that we can, okay? And a human genome with some errors, its sequence is better than nothing, okay? Any questions? But in fact, as you will see, we will get pretty good confidence about things if we sequence large enough fragments accurately enough, and we sequence enough fragments that we get good support from overlays. Okay? Question? Yes?
Why is there
possible to keep back of the order of these pieces? So the question, why is it possible to keep back of the order of these pieces? You would like to read the molecule from left to right, like it's your book, you're saying. Okay? Right. Well, you say it's the first part, the second part. You're dealing with these molecules. Molecules are small things. Okay? You have to now come up with a laboratory technology to take a molecule, cut it up into pieces, and say, this is the first piece, this is the second piece. Okay? You can't take up molecules and move them. Okay? So, bottom line is too hard in the lab to identify uniquely where each fragment is. Okay? So, that's not how they do it. Over the years, people have come up with all kinds of crazy ideas for how you can sequence molecules from left to right. Okay, using mass spectrometers or using all kinds of different things. But in fact, this basic electrophoresis technique, this shotgun technique, is really the same basic idea that was used back in 1977. Okay, and the basic technology is, even when people have been looking for lots of other crazy ideas to sequence better, it's basically endured. Okay? Any questions? Questions?
Right.
So the question is, will the technology, is it possible that the technology will change and someday you'll be able to read molecules from left to right in one piece without this? People sort of assume so, or people basically have always assumed so. I mean, this basic idea of shotgun and fragment assembly is 20, 30 years old. And it seems like an incredibly costly and expensive and wasteful way to do it. And a lot of people have thought of ideas to do it better. I even have a patent on DNA sequencing. So when I had an idea of how I was going to do it better, mass spectrometers had ideas as to how they were going to do it better. And what people found was that this was somehow the most reliable way that could be scaled up to do it, okay? That doesn't mean that people won't come up with other technologies, and maybe they will, but it's kind of like saying that people come up with a better operating system than Microsoft, okay? I mean, in principle, we like to think that such things exist, but somehow Microsoft keeps getting a little bit better every year, good enough to keep its hold on the market. And likewise, this basic technology has survived because nothing else would work better than it. Okay? Maybe someday they will. But, you know, but I wouldn't bet on it right now. Okay? You know, someday maybe, but, you know.
How do you separate the fragments for individual?
How do you separate the fragments for individual sequencing? Well, let me see if I know a way to do it. One way to do it might be, might be by electrophoresis. So one possibility is that you take your sample here, you chop it up in a blender. One step you can do is run it on a gel to separate it by length. Okay? And so then, this section of the gel has all the molecules of about the same length. You can cut that piece of jello out, and now you've got a purer subset of fragments. By doing various purification techniques like that, you can certainly eventually isolate molecules of similar, composition. Okay? So, conceptually, I can believe it can be done, but it's not trivial. Okay? And I don't want to do it. Yes? It's all about, right, so you're really talking about an economics game. You want to sequence a genome. How many dollars will it cost you to sequence a genome? And here we're talking about this case of de novo sequencing. You just want to sequence it from scratch. You don't know about what, you know, you're not trying to figure out the variation between something you sequenced before. You're trying to, from scratch, sequence an organism. Human, dog, mouse, cow, okay? How do you go about doing it? This is the way to do it. They can mass produce these machines. They've gotten very good at mass producing these machines. There is no technology that is on the market today that is better than this, okay? Okay, despite considerable research over the years, okay? Yeah. Well, better per dollar is the important measure here, because people are paying for this. What does it mean to be, you know, not as good per dollar? Okay, it means to be better but more expensive, okay? If you say, well, I only make 1% errors, but I cost 10 times as much to do, the bunch of people will say, well, we'll run mine 5 times. And, the average of all of them, there's not going to be that many errors. So the economics is really the thing driving this. Okay? And this is sort of the most cost-effective technology. Yeah.
The question comes from the fact that if you divide the volume into two parts, then after sequencing, you can always tell whether it's left, right, or right, left. There's only two possibilities, right?
Say that again.
Dividing the molecule only in two parts.
Yeah.
Then you can always tell after sequencing whether it's the left, right, one, or the right, left, one. You can't have two ways of getting things.
Well, okay. There's a question of whether you talk about.
If it's only in two parts, can you tell that?
Okay. The short answer is that this is the way people do it. Okay.
No.
It's not my business to tell these molecular guys how they should be doing working with their molecules. Okay? Over the years, this is basically the way that they have figured out how to do it. Okay? So about this particular protocol, I'm not sure I understand it yet.
I'm saying this because in that case, we can use divide and conquer and just go down. And then we can always tell whether it's a left, right, or right, left. We always go down up to that level. And then it always works. We don't need those.
Okay. First of all, anything that always works can't work here. Because nothing is always true. You're measuring these things, there's errors, there's lots of things to be problematic about. Okay? So this is an era where I think it's time to start to trust the biologists now, that this is a reasonable way to do it. Yes,
question.
So let me assure you that there are several algorithmic computer scientists who have patents on ideas on how you will sequence DNA. I have one. Franco Preparata has one. A lot of other people have them. And all these patents, no one is using. Why is no one using it? Because this is the way that seems to work. Okay, and every one of our other ideas assumes something that doesn't seem to work. Okay, it's too expensive to do it. There's errors. There's, you know. So at this point, we basically understand the technology. At this point, I encourage us to trust the technology and to see how we go and do the reconstruction from here. Any questions?
Exact question.
What? How do you find exact overlaps? Now we're talking about a computational problem. So that's what we're going to focus on over the next couple of. Okay, how do we find the overlaps? Save that. We're going to talk about that over the next couple, over the rest of the next class, the next couple of classes. Okay?
And assume that we know the exact sequence of each complex.
So it's assuming, right, once we have sequenced all the small fragments, the idea here is, suppose, let's say, that I have sequenced enough small fragments of length 500. Here I have a string of length 500, A, C, T, 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 okay? Here I have another fragment of length 500 that overlaps it in 200 bases, let's say. What is the probability that in a string of length a million or a billion, the same pattern of 200 letters in a row occurs exactly? Okay, it will be very, very small. So that will give you good evidence that maybe these things overlap. Okay? And if I now have another third fragment that overlaps this one in 300 bases and this one in 200 bases, okay? That's probably more evidence that my overlap is probably pretty good. So if I have enough overlap and long enough fragments so that it's statistically significant, in principle, I should be able to put it back together again. I might make errors, I might not do it perfectly, I might do a lot of things. There are lots of problems that might come up. But in principle, if I have two fragments that overlap in several hundred bases, that's likely to mean that they probably really are next overlapping each other in the genome. And that's sort of the idea that's going to be used for assembling. Any questions? Okay?
So.
So, how much overlap do we need? Okay, we're now going to randomly sample pieces of the genome. How much sequencing do we need in order to make this whole thing work? Okay? And what we need, since we're going to rely on fragment overlaps to determine where the positions of the fragments go, we have to make sure we sample enough that we get overlaps. Now, what is the worst thing that could happen?
The worst thing that could happen is, here I have a genome, I do lots of samples, lots of old fragments, is if there is some position, okay, where there are no fragments I sampled from, okay? If I ever, remember, I'm randomly going to take these little fragments. In an ideal world, they're going to lie neatly overlapping each other by 50 or 100 base pairs, and everything's going to be beautiful. But if I'm randomly sampling things, there is always going to be a chance that there are certain regions that I never had any samples in. Okay? How can I make the probability that I have no samples in a spot very, very small? Okay? What can I do to make the chance, make the probability that I have a gap at any place very small, yeah? Sequence more and more copies, okay? So the more and more copies I make of the following fragments, the more likely it is I'm going to cover every place. What is the problem with using more and more fragments? Okay? It's more, not only computation, it's $4, okay? If somebody's got to stick this thing into the machine, it's got to grind through the refrigerator, okay, and do this, it costs me a certain amount of dollars to sequence each fragment, okay? How many dollars does it cost to sequence a fragment? You want to say $10 a fragment, $20 a fragment if you're in a mass-produced situation? That still means that if you use twice as many fragments as you need, you double the cost of your project. And these projects cost many millions of dollars to do. So we need to know how much coverage can we, what's the minimum amount of coverage we'd like to get, the minimum amount of samples we need to make it likely that we will sample, not have these gaps. Okay? Is everybody clear to see that that's a meaningful question? Okay?
So, the following kind of equation comes up, okay? Let T be the length of the target molecule we're sequencing, okay? Meaning the length of the molecule that we're sequencing, okay? We want to sequence it using N random fragments, okay? Where each fragment is of length T, and we say that if we have an overlap of length little t, that's good enough to call it to say this overlaps that. Okay? So these are the basic parameters. The length of the genome, the number of fragments we have, the length of each fragment. I'm telling you that the length of each fragment is about 500, and that depends upon the sequencing machines. That's something we can't change. I'd like to sequence fragments of size 5,000, but no one will sell me those machines, so I can't do it. Okay? And we'll say that we'll recognize an overlap of length T as meaningful if it's long enough that it probably didn't happen by chance. Maybe T is 50, 100, something like that. Okay? So, how many gaps would we expect given the number of fragments, the length of the genome, and so on? There's something called the Langer-Waterman equation, okay, which basically tells you that the number of gaps is going to be the length of the genome times e to the this function. Okay? Let's see what that means.
First of all, notice this is a negative function. So e to a negative power goes down. Okay? So the number of gaps is clearly going to increase with n, the length of the genome, because that's what we're multiplying it by. Yeah? Question? N is the number of random fragments, yes. Okay? L minus T, L is the length of each fragment. Okay? Okay. L is the length of each fragment. T is the amount of overlap that counts. So L minus T is the amount of new information you might get in a match. Okay? And it's N times this, basically, length of the fragments divided by the total length of the genome. Okay? So let's think what this means. If the length of the number of fragments times the length of each fragment equals the length of the genome, that means that we sequenced essentially every base in the genome once. Okay? If you have a sequence of a genome length of 1,000 and each piece is of length 500, 2 times 500 is 1,000. At that point, that would be e to the minus 1. That would be, basically about two-thirds of the number of fragments. Okay. The important thing to see here is the following. That the more fragments you have, the more n grows, the quicker this e to the n something goes down. You have no control of L and T, because that's sort of facts of nature. Okay? You need a certain overlap to be meaningful. The fragment length is something that comes off the machine. The genome length is the length of the genome. You can't do anything about that. The only parameter here you control is N, okay, the number of fragments. Okay? And if you sequence enough fragments, this exponent will drive down so the number of gaps gets very small. You want it to get to less than 1. Okay? Any questions? So where does this equation come from? Okay, I always get nervous when I see any equation with an e to the something in it. Okay? I don't know where e comes from. I tend to get nervous about that. Let me just give you at least a little bit of an idea where the e comes from. Suppose, let's say that we had, we wanted to sequence, suppose we have n fragments and n bases. Okay? So we want to try to figure out how many, okay, and each fragment was of length 1. Okay? So let's say that we wanted to analyze the case where we want to cover the n bases. We're doing n samples, and each sample is only going to cover one base. What is the probability that a particular base is not covered at all? Okay? If none of the n fragments cover a particular base I, what is the probability of that? Well, the first fragment is going to cover one of the n bases. Okay? The probability that it doesn't cover the base we have in mind is n minus 1 over n. What's the probability the second base sample does not cover that base? Well, it's also the same thing. Okay, basically there's n minus 1 other possibilities other than the ith position for it to cover. The probability it hits one of them is n minus 1 over n. If we're going to do n such samples, the probability that none of them cover a particular base is n minus 1 over n to the n. Okay, and if you remember your limits, remember back in the days when there was calculus, okay, the limit of this thing worked out to 1 over E. Okay? So E was 2.7 something. 1 over E is about a third, is the way I look at it. Okay? So this would tell us that if we sample it with essentially doing enough sequencing that it would cover every base, that we would get as many bases of raw sequence as the genome had, we would only cover, in fact, about 1 ETH of the genome, one-third of the genome. Okay, right? It would be one-third of it that we didn't cover. Okay? Any questions about that? I don't know if that made it any clearer. Yes?
In terms of limits,
Yeah. Well, it's not B, but when you talk about something, 3 billion, 3 billion is close to infinity as far as I'm concerned. Okay, you think about the limits of things. Okay, you know, limits kick in for large numbers. 3 billion is a large number to me. So this kind of analysis is certainly potentially applicable. Okay, at least as a gross analysis here. Any questions? So when you plot this, what happens? Okay? If you plot, we say that the coverage of a sequencing project is the ratio of the total sequenced fragment length to the genome length. Okay? So what is the sequenced fragment length? Well, if every fragment is length 500, and we sequence n fragments, 500 times n is the amount of raw sequence we have, right? How many letters of raw sequence we get. If 500 times n is less than the length of the genome, I could not possibly have covered everything. Okay, I need to have at least as much raw sequence as the genome. And in fact, I need a lot more than that because I need to have overlaps. The coverage of a project is how many times the length of the genome do I have to get in terms of raw sequence before I can put it together expecting not to have too many gaps. Is that concept of coverage clear, or are there any questions about that? Okay, like I don't understand what you mean by coverage. It's a good question. Okay? Any questions? So what is it, you plug that into the equation, what does this show you? Here, if we have, assume a 1 megabase genome, the size of a bacteria, the amount of coverage you need until you start to expect to have no gaps is about 7 to 10, somewhere in that length. Which means that if you want to sequence a bacteria of length 1 million, you would better expect to get 7 million raw bases to do that, okay, by this method. You need 7 times the size of your genome, or 10, or something like that. If you use a fruit fly-sized genome, how much coverage do you need? If you look at the number of gaps starts to get very low, down around 15 or 20. You need to get, if you have a 100 megabase genome, let's say your fruit fly, you need to sequence 20 times 100 million bases in order to hope to put it back together again. And if you want to try to sequence the human, well, it looks like it gets even worse. Here, it's on the order again. It moves it over some more. Maybe it's 20 times, okay, or 30 times, okay? So you would expect that the number of gaps gets to be very small, okay? Yes? Yep. No, you do not control how many times you duplicate anything. Just sort of duplicate it and make lots of time. I would say you probably don't control the length of the duplication, but by using this electrophoresis and measuring, separating the fragments by length, you can extract fragments of the length that you want. You can extract the molecules of the length that you want before you sequence them.
Okay, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. Okay, so you would like to somehow control this thing. I'm telling you that basically it's called shotgun sequencing. What is a shotgun? A shotgun is this weapon that shoots lots of pellets. It's not very accurate. So how do you kill someone with a shotgun? You go blam, okay, and you shoot lots of fragments at it and hope one of them hits, okay? That is the analogous thing that they're doing here. You cannot pick and choose your molecular fragment. They don't know how to do that. Okay? So that's why, you know, you're forced to deal with random sampling here. Okay? Any questions? Okay? But it should make you realize that notice that the number of gaps when you have even a high amount of coverage, but not at that magic number, you get large numbers of gaps expected. Here, instead of doing 7 times the size of your genome, you only did 5 times. Well, you've got 100 gaps expected or 200 gaps. Closing the gaps in an assembly is an extremely expensive and difficult process. Okay? And notice that the amount of coverage you need grows with the size of your genome. So the people who developed this formula, Landers and Waterman, remember Landers' name, he's a famous guy. Both of them are famous guys. But Landers is famous because he wanted to sequence the human genome. And he took a look at his equation and said, wait a second. To sequence something of size in the order of 1 billion, not only do I have to sequence 1 billion things, I have to sequence 20 billion things or 30 billion things. This seems that doing a shotgun strategy like this is going to be hopelessly expensive. I got to find another way to do it. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Question? Okay, how many gaps are there in the current genome? To be honest with you, I do not know. But the question of gaps gets even more complicated for a couple of reasons. Okay?
First of all,
this analysis that we did was assuming the sequence was a random, the human genome was a random sequence. The human genome is not a random sequence. There are a lot of weird things that happen in the genome. Remember how we caught O.J. Simpson, the murderer, from the spot of blood on the floor?
How did we do that? Remember, was by not noticing, counting how many duplicates there were in the genome? There are various points in the genome where you have short repetitions of several thousand bases. Okay? AT, 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 impossible to assemble over that gap. Why? Because if it's all you've got are 500 bases to match, here you're going to have fragments that end in AT, AT, AT. Here you have fragments that start with AT, AT, AT. You have no idea if there's anything in between. Okay? And if there is more than one such region, AT, 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 there is no possible way to span this gap, figure out if this overlaps with that. Okay? So there's going to be some gap that get created, because the string is not random, and the situation is even worse than we see here. Okay? So that's one source of problem. This analysis assumes the best possible case that the string is random. So in fact, you need even more coverage and have even more problems. Okay? Question. Do you know what? If I know the length of the overlap, you're telling me, I might be able to tell something like this. But based on what I've told you so far, I don't see where, just with the technology we have now, we have no way of doing it. If there's a region of ATATAT that spans 2,000 bases, okay, and all you've got a fragment of size 500, you have no way of knowing how, you know, where it start. And what's worse, even if you know that they're that, oh, okay, here's 2,000 bases, if this repeat occurs in multiple places, I have no way of knowing that the matching end is here or the matching end is here. Okay, so I can't assemble things across these big repeats. The repeats are trouble. We're going to have to realize that the sequence has repeats, and they're going to give us even more trouble. So this is the best possible case. Question? So what if I break AT&T into multiple fragments, sort of, I guess, like the judge did with the phone company many years ago, broke AT&T into many fragments. Okay? AT, 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 AT. I mean, again, you're sort of stuck. The sequence of reads here is always going to be AT, AT, AT. The sequence from here to here is AT and AT. If I have two longer repeats, you can't get across it with a fragment of size 500. Okay? That should sort of be clear. So
So we've got a limit here. We're sort of assuming that there are going to be these bad repeats. In a random string of like the billion, there should be such bad repeats. The trouble is there are such bad repeats. Okay, we'll have to deal with it. Any questions?
Question.
You're saying that if the sequence is not that random, maybe you can do it with less coverage. Okay, if the sequence was completely not random and you knew it in advance, you could do it with no coverage. Okay? Now the question then is, I guess the way I would think about it is the sequence is not random enough to cause trouble, but not so highly structured that you can predict it in advance. Okay? It's not the decimal expansion of some number or anything like that. Okay? So, realize it's a random sequence, but not a completely random sequence. Okay? And that's going to cause more trouble. Any questions? Yes?
Actually, you can't calculate the length of the entire...
Great question. Can you calculate the length of the entire genome? The answer is not perfectly.
So if you say something, I will tell you the human genome is 3 billion bases long. Does 3 billion mean 2.96 is the wrong answer? No. It's sort of there's that much level of uncertainty. So you can measure length, but you can't measure these things perfectly. So any trick that's going to assume, aha, I know there's exactly 7,356 bases between here, is doomed to failure. Saying I know there's somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000, maybe you can exploit that. Okay? But anything you know exactly isn't going to work. Any questions? Okay?
So, so what is the important point here? Okay? That again, even in random strings, if you're going to use a shotgun sequencing, you need a very high coverage. That's what the analysis here shows, to minimize the chances of gaps. Okay? And the amount of coverage you need, the multiplier times the length of the genome you need, grows with the size of the genome. Okay? That's why people got scared at sequencing big projects. Okay? Any other questions? Okay? So, let's talk a little bit more about the technology of... there's a little bit more about the technology of where you get these fragments here. Okay? We agree that the effectiveness of the sequencing strategy depends upon the coverage. Because assembly is such a hard problem in a purely shotgun way, okay, sometimes you have some alternate auxiliary data to tell you where the pieces are. Okay? So sometimes there's things called mapping data that will help you with your assembly by telling you roughly where you think the fragments are. Okay? And so the difference between two different sequencing strategies are going to be how much do they rely on pure shotgun sequencing, randomly sampling and putting together some overlaps, and how much do they depend upon analysis, mapping data, getting auxiliary data and mapping it. Okay? So what do I mean by that? So what other technologies do we need to know about? I told you there were two different groups that sequenced the human genome at the same time. One was Celera, which basically did a shotgun sequencing strategy. Another was the public consortium effort led by this guy, Eric Lander, who made up that equation, who said gaps are going to be trouble. So what did Eric Lander do? Okay. He said it's going to be too complicated for me to, too expensive to shotgun sequence the genome.
So what Lander did was the following. He took his group, essentially, took the human genome, and very carefully broke up into a small number of pieces, okay, a large number of larger pieces. Okay? So instead of breaking it up into fragments of size 500, he broke it up into fragments of, let's say, 1 million. Okay? Or 50,000 or something like that. So now, instead of a lot of small pieces to sequence, he had a lot of large pieces to sequence. Okay?
What he was hoping to do was to figure out where those large pieces go. Okay? And then, since we agree that you need smaller coverage to sequence a smaller piece, if he only had this, if he took his billion-based project, broke it up into pieces of size 1 million, could figure out where the pieces of size 1 million overlap, identify a small subset of pieces of size 1 million, which would do the job, and then sequence these pieces of size 1 million, he could get away with less total sequencing. Why is that? Because the coverage you need to sequence something of length 1 million is less than you need for something of length 1 billion. And so if you could identify a smaller number of pieces, not randomly sample large pieces, but identify a small number of large pieces, such that if he could sequence all those large pieces, he could put it all together. Okay? That would be seemingly a more efficient way to do it. And so to do that, he needed a way to figure out if two molecules overlap without actually sequencing them. Okay? And the way that he would try to do that is with some auxiliary laboratory work, basically called mapping. Okay? Any questions about what I'm saying? I think I'm losing people here a little bit. Okay? So in a mapping technology, what he's now got is he has broken up the human genome, okay, into big fragments, let's say about 2 billion long. They were called BACs or YACs. The name's not so important. Okay? But these sequences of length 2 billion he could duplicate, he could do things with. And he could also, to a certain extent, figure out whether they overlap each other without actually sequencing them. How might you be able to figure out if two fragments overlap without actually sequencing them? Well, there are a couple of laboratory technologies which could basically, given a molecule, ask whether it contains a particular sequence. Okay? These things might be called restriction digests. You might sometimes hear them called express sequence tags. Okay? There are certain technologies that, given a molecule, you can ask the question, hey molecule, do you have this pattern in you? Okay? Without sequencing the whole molecule. You can do this in a test tube. So what could he do? Well, he could take his pieces of size 1 million, and he could say, hey, do you have this pattern of length 25? Okay, maybe this pattern named A. Okay, and so let's say two of the fragments have that molecule of length 25, and only two of them do. Then that means that they probably overlap, right? Because if the two molecules shared the sequence of length 25, that meant that they overlapped, okay, in that region of the molecule length 25. So the ability to ask a molecule, do you have a particular pattern, or which these molecules have a particular pattern, if you get lucky, that pattern will only exist in two fragments, okay, and then you can, based on that, decide that these two fragments overlap each other. And by asking enough questions, enough mapping information, you can identify a small set of million-length molecules that in principle cover the genome, and then reduce your sequencing problem to that of sequencing these million-long molecules. Any questions? Okay? That, I think, was probably a little bit unclear. Okay? Next class, any questions about that, though? Okay, next class we're going to talk more about the sequence, the technologies of mapping, okay, and then get into the algorithmics of how do you really put these sequences, assemble them back together again. Any questions? Okay, thank you.